I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Why have we seen so many children, teenagers, and adults diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? For parents and teens, ADHD can be a troubling diagnosis on top of an already difficult period in a child's life. Many teens have trouble following through on instructions and don't seem to listen when spoken to directly, but it's important to know when a teen is just being a teen or when their condition requires special attention. Today, psychologist Wes Crenshaw talks about ADHD's effect on family relationships and dispels some myths. Later on this hour, Brian McTavish gets our attention and gives us some ideas for weekend fun. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The news last summer on the attention deficit hyperactivity disorder front was distressing. Nearly 1 in 10 kids in the U.S. has been diagnosed with ADHD, the government said. That was nearly a jump of 2% compared to a decade ago. Whether the numbers were a true increase or just a matter of better detection was unclear. But children who struggle to pay attention, control impulsive behavior, or fidget incessantly are often diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Today, a conversation about ADHD, its effect on family relationships, and some myths surrounding ADHD in teens. With us once again today is psychologist and parenting expert Dr. Wes Crenshaw, who has written a pair of books titled Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens. He specializes in working with adolescents and families in his private practice over in Lawrence. He writes the Double Take advice column in the Lawrence Journal World, and he joins me right now. Wes, always good to have you. Good morning.
And nice to be here.
Well, why have so many more teenagers as well as children and adults been diagnosed here? What's going on out there, Wes?
Well, there's the big question.
It's been going on for a while, too, right?
Well, it has. About a 20-year phenomenon.
Yeah, right.
And you really hit on the alleged controversy as to whether this is better detection or there are those in the conspiracy theory world who believe psychiatrists are conspiring with frustrated parents and drug companies to over-medicate everybody. And so that's sort of – those are the two extremes. My view of it is that detection is really a lot better than it's ever been. It certainly is something we're more aware of as clinicians.
As opposed to some grand conspiracy out there by the drug companies to get kids signed up on these drugs then.
Well, yeah. And I neither own stock in any of those companies nor am I terribly trusting of them as large profit-making corporations. But as a face-to-face person with – people with ADD, I see the benefits that that can bring for those who are properly diagnosed.
So you're convinced then that this is a matter of doctors being more, aware of the disorder and recognizing it more often? Is that what you're seeing then?
There are kind of two factors. That is definitely one of them. The other thing is, and my undergraduate degrees are actually in sociology, political science, and history. My PhD is in psychology. So I have a kind of sociological view of things. And it's my thought that we've really shifted in what it means to go to school, what it means to learn, and what it means to be in the workplace over the period since you and I got out of college toward much more cognitive work.
So, meaning what exactly?
Well, you're doing more thinking per minute in this world today than we were doing when you and I were 17.
And the effect of that then is what?
It's harder for the ADD people. Mm-hmm. They have to process that much more information, and if there's a deficit to begin with in their ability to process that, that's going to show up much more now in our high-speed, high-tech society.
And so these kids then are going out and seeking help more often than they used to, and maybe that contributes to these numbers we're seeing too.
That plays in also because the stigma around mental health concerns in the last 20 years has all but lifted. It is really
That's an amazing thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's kind of neat for me because that's my biz, but it's also, I think, good for society. And it's routine now. I see a lot, mostly teenagers and their families. It's routine for teenagers to refer each other to me at this point and to feel no worry or shame about that. And that's kind of nice, but it also makes it more of our opportunity to see them and to interact with them and to know what's wrong with them. And so, therefore, you're going to identify more people.
You know, not to step off on a tangent, but let's do it anyway. I mean, when we were kids, the stigma of anything related to mental illness was so extreme, so strong. I am amazed to hear and relieved to hear what you're saying. Maybe not entirely surprised, just given and reading about things. But man, what a change this is.
Absolutely true. And when I entered this business, I've been doing this for 18 or 19 years now. When I entered this business, that's very much what you would see. And people saw mental health spending in their budget as discretionary spending. Today, that is seen as necessary spending. People are budgeting for mental health concerns for their kids and for themselves. And that is a significant change over 20 years.
And it changed because why?
Well, again, if you go to the sociological idea, I think society has changed. I think the world is harder to live in today for teenagers than when you and I were in
high
school.
Harder to live in for me, Wes.
Yeah.
I mean, holy smokes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we've done a lot of things that are both cool and awful. You know, the fact that I assume you interact with your machines the way I do, my phone and my, you know, Twitter. I never thought I would utter the words my Twitter account, but sure enough, and my computer. And these tools give us a whole lot of opportunities, but they also tax us very subtly in ways that I don't think we're always aware of. And so that kind of overwhelming environment does make it harder to cope, both for the folks who have anxiety and the folks who have ADD.
Is there a modern day sort of hero or heroine when it comes to sort of leading us into a new awareness and understanding of the importance of mental health these days?
Boy, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I think it's more of a team effort, if you will. You know, you look at the years of the past, like Carl Menninger, and if you go back further, Sigmund Freud, there was a great interest in the late 60s and early 70s in mental health. My dad was a minister but also kind of a junior psychologist, and it was very interesting to read I'm Okay, You're Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I actually read I'm Okay, You're Okay when I was 10.
Yeah.
And so there was a great interest in that, but it still was sort of like at a distance. You didn't say, I have depression. You said, isn't it interesting to study transactional analysis?
Mm.
And so there's been that interest, but I think it's more of a team effort now that mental health providers have done a better job of including people and making people feel less stigmatized, and there's been a movement in that direction, both in schools and in practice.
Well, going back to ADHD, what exactly is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
Well, and you'll hear me switch back and forth. I usually just call it ADD. We have two
that's
types.
That's how I know it, actually.
Yeah, yeah. There really are two types. There's ADD inattentive type and ADD hyperactive type, and then there's combined type.
Ah.
And that almost gets too complicated to figure out the difference at times. But there are two distinct sets. The people who are not hyperactive and who are inattentive, and they are a little harder to detect because they're not climbing the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are the traditional hyperactive ones, and as children, they're the ones who seem to be driven by a motor, is the old phrase. As adults, they're the ones who are always restless, always changing jobs, always wanting to be where they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the two distinctions, and then there are those who overlap.
Well, how do you pick out the kids with ADHD from the rest of the pack, particularly with younger kids?
Yeah, it's a little dicey when they're very young, and this becomes a little bit of a problem because one doesn't want to overdiagnose. People will go out and say, oh, too many people are diagnosed. I doubt that's true. I think there are people who are incorrectly diagnosed.
And how often does that happen?
It's hard to tell because if you knew, then there wouldn't be anybody who was incorrectly diagnosed because
mm-hmm.
you'd quit diagnosing them. But it's usually the product of a poor diagnostic system. And, you know, we can talk a little about that. But the picking out the kids, it becomes easier in first or second grade. My son and daughter both have ADD, so I get this coming and going at the office and at home.
Mm-hmm.
And my little boy is very smart and a very good student in second grade, and he could literally not sit in his seat in kindergarten. He stood by his desk for the whole year.
Was that okay with his teacher?
Well, that was their workaround, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And by first grade, we realized we're just going to have to accept we've got two of these kids now. It's not just developmental. And that's what you're trying to rule out. You're trying to decide, is this just a part of being a little kid, Or does he stand out so much in comparison to his peers that something else is going on?
And so the earliest you can accurately make an assessment then would generally be when?
Well, I think we knew in kindergarten.
Yeah. Well, in your case.
Yeah. Usually you're going to see the symptoms. I like to hold off a little at that age and wait and see if it's developmental. But by first or second grade, a lot of that's going to appear. And then the question is, how good is the child at working around it? And they may get by for years working around it. And then they'll hit eventually what I call their Waterloo, where the work becomes too hard. And for most kids, that's going to be 7th or 8th grade. And for some, it doesn't hit until college. And I have had law school students who finally become overwhelmed when they have to read all those journals. And it's very clear they have that history, but they had these ways of working around it.
So how important, then, is it to get an early assessment? Is that a big deal in this whole realm of ADHD?
I think it is. And there's one very particular reason why. Is if you begin treatment in an earlier age, kids grow up understanding how people really are supposed to think. And what it's kind of delightful when a 15-year-old comes in, and I have a bunch of them, comes in, gets on medicine, gets some training from us and says, oh, my God, I didn't know this is how normal people thought. I didn't know you could finish a book. I didn't know you could think problems in your head. That's a beautiful day. But the problem is they've spent 10 years by then not learning the information, retaining the information, reading books, having the joy that comes with that, and interacting with others in a conventional way. And so you kind of feel sad at the same time you're excited that we've now discovered the secret. So I like to get it as early as is reasonable.
So everyone's on the same page.
Right.
The teacher understands what's going on. Mom and dad get it, the whole thing.
And the kid learns how to be not as ADD. When you're on medicine, you're just not as ADD. And my little boy, he would have been an interesting guest. He once said to me, you know, when and he's 8, he says, when we do my medicine, we really need to balance my tolerance with my focus. Because what he's saying is if he's on too much medicine, he's very short and ill-tempered. And if he's on the right amount of medicine, he focuses without that. That's his ability to understand his own problem and report it to us. And if you start that early, it's very helpful down the road.
How early do you typically place kids on medication?
Well, it usually, again, once you know, if you have a good diagnosis and you've done the testing, first or second grade is not too soon.
Mm-hmm.
I know that just seems hideous, doesn't it?
But yeah.
it is an amazing difference when my kid can come home and talk about school and read a book and enjoy school as opposed to feeling like he couldn't get through the day.
But that's that idea of starting kids that early is going to make a lot of parents nervous.
Oh, it weirded me out, and I'm in the business.
Mm-hmm.
Daughter, we waited until my daughter was in about third grade, and that was 3 grades too long. She just did not have as much benefit.
And the price for your daughter then was what?
I think she became very frustrated with school those first 3 years. And mm-hmm. and I use these kiddos as an example because I can break their confidentiality. These are illustrative of most of the cases I see.
Yeah.
And the benefit they get from the medicine properly administered and properly diagnosed is really remarkable.
Well, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking this morning with Dr. Wes Crenshaw about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And if you suffer from ADHD yourself or are a parent of someone who is and can offer other parents who might be listening some advice on attention deficit disorder, we'd like to hear from you. There's a bunch of ways to get a hold of us. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Our email, uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. And I should just point out that Wes Crenshaw will be at Rainy Day Books in Fairway today from 12:30 to 1:30, signing books right after the show today. So you'll be scooting
out of here pretty quickly, it sounds like.
I will be. This is just kind of our little impromptu KCUR listeners event today.
There you go. Well, and the most common treatment then for ADHD, what kind of medicine are we talking about here and what does it do?
There are really only two, and they are very old medicines. And I should do my quick disclaimer. I'm not a medical doctor and I don't prescribe, but any psychologist who does this work encounters these medicines and has to have a command and understanding of them, and I have it as a parent too. All of the medicines for ADD that are really effective are either based on amphetamines or on Ritalin, or what the generic term is, methylphenidate.
And those drugs do what to the body?
I could give you the long neurological boring example, but the short version is they create more dopamine in the brain, which in the particular location in the brain causes a person to be able to focus better and then clean out the things that aren't important around them as they're trying to perceive the world.
So it slows them down?
Not at all. An interesting thing about the ADD people, many of them can drink a pot of coffee and go to bed because the stimulant effect does not affect them like it does you and I. You and I drink a pot of coffee and we're up all night. The same is true of Ritalin and Adderall. And they stimulate a specific part of the brain that lets you decide not to be interested in things that are not important. And so that lets you then focus on what is important. And that's just about how it goes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Heather from Gardner on the Kansas side. Heather, good morning.
Good morning. I just had a question. I have a son who's 5 and he's in kindergarten. And as of yesterday, we had to put him in a special reading program because he's already having problems focusing. But my question really comes down to, these teachers have concerns and they come to you and you're wondering, how do you know the difference between what is a normal boy behavior in school? Because in my opinion, school is not really geared towards young boys. And what is problematic, like worrisome behavior or symptoms of this? Because I don't want this to be a problem that we could prevent future issues. I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Yeah, that's right. On
behavior of young boys.
Right on the money as a question. The true ADD person who is hyperactive, forget for a second about just the inattentive ones, will stand out in the population of little boys. So you got to understand ADD is only – no diagnosis is a diagnosis unless it discriminates from the population. So if everyone were depressed in the world, there would be no depression. We wouldn't see it as different. If everyone were ADD, we wouldn't see anyone as different. So the little boy in your case, if he is significantly different from his peer group in his hyperactivity, then that is a possible diagnosis. And when we talk about testing, we're talking about comparing a person to the norm group, not looking at them, not doing a symptom checklist. It has to be a scored test. So that would be the first place to start with this little guy. Secondly,
for a parent who's interested in sort of watching that, should they go call the teacher up and say, I want to sit in the classroom for a few hours and watch myself to see what
we're seeing? Parents are not very objective observers.
That's
I
right.
know I'm not, and I'm trained to be. I think if you could get a third party to go in that's your psychologist or therapist that's not connected with the school, that's the most objective observation.
Does that happen sometimes?
Oh, I've done it many times.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a little better observation. But we have checklists. There's several that are standardized instruments that are filled out by the parent, the teacher, and usually the child when they're old enough to fill it out, and another observer. And all those are fed into a computer program and compared with a norm group. That's a better diagnostic methodology.
Okay, that's something to think about then. Okay, more phone calls here. Let's go to Vanessa from Overland Park. Vanessa, good morning.
Good morning. I so appreciate what you guys are talking about today, and I wanted to see if maybe you could explain some of the symptoms for adult ADD and maybe differentiate just from adapted personality traits in probably dealing with it for a long time. So I will take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Vanessa, thank you. Symptoms for adult ADDs. Go ahead.
Well, this is what's tricky because the diagnostic manual is about to change. And the diagnostic manual number 4 that we've used since I've been in the business is really aimed at children. And so there aren't that many adults that are driven like a motor and all of these little kid kind of diagnoses. So the criteria for adults is a little more complicated. And it's usually more behavioral. If you cannot finish a project, if you have trouble starting a project, if you cannot organize your life like your peers can, if you're unusually messy, if you have a number of auto accidents for inattentive driving, even those which are not your fault, that is actually a symptom. It's not probably going to be in the book, but it's one we see.
Vanessa also asked about adaptive behaviors and what people might do to compensate versus, you know, to might disguise some of these things.
Well, the most common disguise for ADHD is the 25% of people who also have an anxiety disorder or lean towards having anxiety. 25% of the ADD people also have an anxiety disorder. And this, they are both the most successful ADD people and the most tortured because they are getting it coming and going. The anxious people care too much and the ADD people don't care enough. And I don't mean they don't care about the environment or their friends. They just don't notice the things they should notice. When you put those two things together, they don't play well. But it does help someone get through.
Let's go back to some calls. And Mary from Olathe. Mary, you're on with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just was going to touch on what you just touched on, sir. My son was diagnosed with ADD when he was in early grade school. We didn't start any medication until he was about in fifth grade, but he had the symptoms of ADD, totally the acting out in class, can't sit still, fidgety, jumping up and down. But what we've come to realize now, he's in his 20s, that it was anxiety. He was having basically little kid versions of anxiety attacks. And, you know, he couldn't say, I'm having an anxiety attack.
Right.
And he still, you know, suffers greatly with anxiety. And it just tied into what you just said. I was already on the phone waiting, but that was my... You know, I felt as though we kind of got a misdiagnosis.
Yeah. Mary, hang on a minute. How do you help folks like Mary's son?
The diagnostic issue is really critical. She's correct there. And this is why, you know, I love physicians. They're good to me and they refer people. We generally would prefer diagnosis come from a psychologist or a clinical social worker, someone who really works a lot with this, because it's easy to misdiagnose these things. And you have to be able to talk with kids and watch them and interact with them and hear the parents describe what's going on. And so if a person is saying, my child has trouble going to sleep every night because he has nightmares, that leans more towards anxiety than he has trouble going to sleep because he just rolls around and gets up and walks around. That leans towards ADD,
right,
for one of 1,000 examples.
Okay. Mary,
yes.
Hope that helps.
Yes. Thank you so much.
All the best.
Consider. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Kevin, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a 30-year-old male, and I was wondering – everybody has kind of assumed that I have ADD, and I just kind of tossed it by the wayside. I'm wondering, first of all, how you get tested at my age, and second, would it make any difference if I was? Because I do associate a lot with the symptoms you were mentioning. Can't start a project, can't finish a project, very scattered, but yet fairly successful in my work. Those are the questions that I have kind of rolling around in my brain.
Yeah, Kevin, hang on a minute. Go ahead, Wes.
Okay. So many possibilities here. The first thing to do, testing is easy to do. And the only warning I will give is just the other day, man, it's been a couple months, I got a battery of tests from a different state with someone coming in. And that person had done $2,200 worth of testing for ADT. This is not necessary. $200-$300, much of which insurance will pay for, will cover that. You just want to make sure that you're going to someone who's actually giving you the tests and scoring them and does an interview with you and has a discussion about your developmental history through school. Second, whether it will help you or not is totally dependent on how impaired you feel you are at this point. I have saved more marriages getting people with ADHD correctly diagnosed than I can shake a stick at. And getting that taken care of often really improves those relationships. I've saved jobs that way. If you're doing fine in all your spheres of life, for heaven's sakes, don't take medicine just to be on medicine. But if you feel that there's an impairment, it's worth exploring.
Kevin, I hope that helps.
It does. Thank you very much.
You bet. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Richard from Kansas City, Kansas. Richard, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am male, 41, and I assume that you would recognize that when we were younger, a lot of times we were just called hyper.
Or lazy, and that's the saddest one.
Well, mine, in my case, it was hyper, very talkative, very movable, standing next to my desk in kindergarten, et cetera. Now, back then in the 70s, I feel like they solved it by simply giving me something to do.
Right.
And that seemed to work. Now, as an adult, to bring it forward, I've never been diagnosed. I've never been checked for this. But I have more and more friends of mine, especially younger friends, saying, dude, you should try Ritalin or blah, blah, blah. I'm the type of person that can drink a coffee right before bed, as you were describing before. And also, I find a lot of medicines that are supposed to make me drowsy or up seem to do the reverse. Anyway, what's helped me the most, I think, is physical activity, which is what I was going to mention and get your opinion on. If I go take a two-mile walk, et cetera, if I go rake the leaves, I feel an awful lot better. My mind stops working, and I get into sort of almost a very meditative zone of doing instead of thinking. And that stopping of the thinking seems to really help me. Anyway, I'm curious to get your comments on physical activity and its benefit in any of your studies.
There is no question whatsoever that people with hyperactivity benefit from physical activity and exercise and sports. The problem we run into is Michael Phelps is one of the few people you will find in sports at the national level that has ADD. And part of the reason is the same problems that make it hard to study make it hard to practice and do all the unbelievable levels of physical exercise it takes to be really serious about sports or to even run a treadmill or get up every day and do that routine. But that is absolutely helpful. It will not cure ADD. And the one other thing I would add is hyperactivity is not the biggest problem with ADD, even with little kids. If you can run around the classroom and learn, that's annoying to everybody, but it isn't a problem. It's the inattention. And so if you're doing okay with managing your hyperactivity by walking or running or, you know, God forbid, playing a video game, great, have at it. Mm-hmm. It's the inattentive part that gets people.
Right. Well, and I would add real quick, thanks for the time. I do design work on the computer. I'm on the computer constantly, and I will say that sometimes a benefit, sometimes not, but maybe you could address the difference in our world in the last 30 years of how many of us are sitting in the exact same spot, staring at 7 inches or 20 inches most of the day, as opposed to doing other things, and how maybe that's actually affecting our culture and our ability to deal with it. Anyway, thanks so much for your
interesting thoughts. Richard, thank you for the phone call. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Wes Crenshaw about attention deficit disorder. We'll talk a little bit more about how ADHD affects families, and we'll also bring Brian McTavish here to give us our weekend to-do list, which includes a little visit with Mr. Sulu from Star Trek. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star. And you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation yesterday about the most private public woman, Queen Elizabeth II, you'll find it in all of our older broadcasts at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, the DVD gurus jump back 50 years and share their favorite films from 1962. This hour, we're visiting with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. We're talking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And we were talking earlier on, what are some of the myths, Wes, when it comes to all of this that people should be aware of?
Well, I think the biggest one is that it doesn't exist or that it's overdiagnosed. I think there are misdiagnoses, but there's not this big movement to get all the kids on medicine. And people get angry at schools because I think part of that myth is that the teachers just want everybody calmed down. Well, you know, certainly they do, but I don't think teachers are militantly marching our kids off a Ritalin cliff. Mm-hmm. So those are the big ones.
Yeah. And also, the impact of ADHD on families, it must be profound. You must see it all the time in your practice.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And I kind of mentioned the marriages earlier. It's very difficult for ADD folks to maintain marriages or to maintain interest in marriages. If you think about it, I've been married 27 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the definition of repetitive. Well, mm-hmm. being married, if you have ADHD for 27 years, is the same day over and over again. And that is very hard when you seek novelty. That's the core issue in ADD, is the search for novelty. And for kids, they're already struggling with a lot of different issues. So if they're having inattention and the behavioral problems that may go along with that and the school problems that go along with it, it produces a very hopeless feeling a lot of the time for them in mm-hmm. families.
Debbie from Kansas City, Missouri, welcome to Up to Date. Debbie.
Oh, hi there. I unfortunately have to agree with your guest's comments at the top of the program. I wish it were the case, but the stigma of mental illness and the acceptance of mental illness, it hasn't got better. I have two adult sons now with ADHD, depression, and anxiety. And if you take them to, yes, the mental health profession has got better at treating it, but you take them to a general hospital, they look at it like they're just there to get meds. And then you also said something about more funding. If you look at any state government, look at Kansas, Missouri, it's been cut every year. So I need to unfortunately take you to task about that statement. It's just not true.
Well, I wouldn't take my mental illness issues to a regular hospital for the reason I cited earlier. I think mm-hmm. that's not what they're designed to treat. And we have a very strong installed base of private and public providers in the area that work with those kinds of issues. Now, what I'd said about funding is that families have now learned to set aside part of their medical budget for purchasing services. You're not kidding that state funding has been cut. And I know for Missouri it's particularly difficult. For Kansas, the Medicaid programs exist for poor folks, for persons in poverty, to get services, but it's so difficult as a provider to take those contracts that I've given up. I took Medicaid for many years, and I just gave up. It's too difficult, and it's too risky. So you're correct about that.
Again, Dr. Wes Crenshaw will be at the Fairway store of Rainy Day Books today from 12:30 to 1:30, signing some of his books if you want to go by and actually meet Wes in person. What a thrill that would be for so many folks. Dan from Overland Park, you're on Up to Date. Dan, good morning.
Hi, I tutor kids with ADD and ADHD here at Johnson County Community College.
Oh, thank God for you. I'm telling you, that's the best program in the state.
Yeah, it's a really good program. I'm wondering if we have any research that indicates how much of ADD has a genetic component and how much of it might be fostered by the environment we live in that looks to me like it's increasingly full of distractions.
You can predict ADHD in a child better than you can predict height. The genetic component is that strong. It will skip a generation. It did in my family. Neither my wife or I have it. We know where it came from, though. I'm not telling. I'm not telling on the person. But what we have is what's called a genotype and a phenotype. And if a person has an underlying genetic propensity for anything, ADD, depression, anxiety, that does not necessarily activate until they're in certain environments. And school tends to drive ADD up for reasons that mm-hmm. should be obvious. They're asking people to do things. I think school is now driving anxiety up dramatically. I think particularly in junior high and high school, it is very anxiety-producing to even be there. So, yeah, I think there's both those components, and we're always studying the issue you're bringing up.
Dan, hang on a second. What's so great about the program out at Johnson County Community College?
I'm just in love with Johnson County, so I'm biased. But I think they work so well. I refer young people there all the time. I've written many reports for their office that this gentleman works with. And I just think they really go out of their way to accommodate students with ADHD, providing quiet rooms and all the things that are required under the 501 clause. Mm-hmm. But 504 clause. But they just do it with joy. You know, I don't ever feel like they're annoyed by having to do that. It's really a good program.
Well, Dan, thanks for your good work out there.
You bet. And I should also note the program is not just for kids with ADD and ADHD, but also kids who are blind or are deaf. Or we work with kids who have a variety of learning disabilities.
And they do so very well.
All right. Thanks again, Dan.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Christy from Overland Park. Christy, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. We have a son, 8-year-old boy, with diagnosed with both ADHD and OCD. He's taking medication for both of those things. And I'm wondering, are there other things we can do regarding his diet to help manage his symptoms?
Well, you're on one of the tough dual diagnosis situations. When I said the anxious folks are, and the anxious ADD people are the most tortured, the anxious are the ADD OCD people are even more so, because those two disorders don't play well together at all. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of good conclusions at all from diet research in these areas. And I always just tell people that a good diet is going to be your best ally. You know, all the things they tell you to eat, fruits and vegetables, all that kind of stuff. But there's no evidence that any of the special diets do much good for that.
Hmm. We have an interesting email here from Linda, who writes us this. I would recommend that no one of any age be diagnosed until they, one, regularly eat a diet of nutrient-dense organic food, two, drink purified water, three, sleep adequate hours for their age, four, receive liberal exercise and fresh air, five, use electronic stimulation less than an hour a day, and six, avoid processed food products.
Well, I think that's great advice.
Is it?
Sure. But the problem is the research does not tell us that when you do those things, you detract people from ADHD. That's the problem, even though I think those foods are better for us and probably do all of us. And she should have thrown in there, eat lots of fish or fish oil. Mm-hmm. That has research behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, those things have been experimented to death. And the NPR feed talked about that a few weeks ago, and there's just not any evidence it changes the course of ADD.
Well, speaking of that, are there any, you know, non-medication alternatives in treating ADHD, or like special diets or anything else besides medicine?
The research tells us that the first line of defense in ADHD is medicine. And as a psychologist, it would be super neat for me if that weren't true, because then I'd sell my special therapy and be able to make that happen. But as therapists, we know that we are providing a really important adjunct to medication management for people to learn how to cope and organize, because medicine doesn't really solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It puts the fuel in the car, and then you have to decide where to drive.
Along those lines, Devin Olathe writes us this: would you address alternative treatment of ADHD in children? We're confident our 5-year-old has it. My husband and stepdaughter both do. We don't want medication to be the only support for her, although we understand that it may have to be at least a component. What kind of counseling, therapy, rehab is available for kids?
Yeah, great question, and that plays right off of what we were talking about. The therapy we mustn't think of the therapy as being like getting to your secret childhood issue that, you know, made you ADD.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about learning how to organize your life effectively, and that is a constant process. It's kind of a coaching process, but I hate to use that word because it's become kind of stigmatized. But it's learning. I forgot to bring them, but I have my 12 principles for the ADD people to live by, and I'll put that on my website if people want to read it in the next day or two. But I have my 12 principles I make people put on their phone so they can read it every day.
We'll put a link on our website at kcur.org to Dr. Wes Crenshaw's website as well. Daniel from Topeka. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
I have a question about the medications available to treat adult ADHD and the possible what benefits and possible side effects.
Okay. That is an hour-long program, but I'm going to give you the super fast version. I don't want to make it sound like stimulant medication is happy unicorns running through a field and you singing with flowers in your hair. There are some problems. And learning how to manage that medicine is part of that counseling and discussion that we talked about in the last call. And at the top of the list of problems is not about 37% of people's brains respond better to the Adderall-type medicines, and about 37% respond better to Ritalin-based medicines, and the rest are difficult to treat.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest problem you're going to run into is appetite suppression, and we have to coach people on how to eat, because this isn't research-proven, but it's a Westism that I think if you're hungry, you're probably not on enough medicine. It is really goes hand in hand with managing the ADD. So teaching people how to eat regular six small meals a day so that your blood sugars don't drop is a critical part of that. Sleep can be inhibited by these medicines, and you can run into some problems with agitation or mood change, and we don't want that. So what we try to do are tiny incremental changes that go between the doses so that you don't have as much of a rebound on and off of them.
I hope that helps, Daniel.
There's one other quick thing. You've got to take breaks about 3 or 4 times a year. These medicines, just like coffee, build tolerance quickly. And a lot of times prescribers do not say this. And you need to take about a week's break 3 or 4 times a year for them to continue to be effective.
So how long do children typically tend to be on these medications then?
It's kind of a debate about this. About 70% of people who have it as a child will have it as an adult. The question is, what's the deal with the other 30%? And no one is quite sure. Do they really outgrow it, or do they just not need to be on it because they're out of school? Hmm. But generally, you're going to be on it whenever you're learning or functioning in a learning-type setting or a work setting. And so that's why one has to manage the medicine for long-term use. And if you don't manage it that way, you'll max out on it and it won't be as effective anymore.
Where's the research? Where are we headed with ADHD down the road? What do you see coming?
Well, that's such a broad area. The research is very strong on this, and it continues to point us all in the same direction. What would be so great is if we could find another medicine that would be a little less side effects and as effective. And they've tried that multiple times, and it always comes back to our old buddies, Ritalin and Adderall-based mm-hmm. medicines. And mm-hmm. so there's always medication research on that. The behavioral interventions continue to be just about like what we've described today.
Yeah. Well, Wes, it's always good to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
It's great. Love to be here.